Welcome back, everyone, to Understanding Climate Finance. My name is Fahim Nurali, and I am the Climate Finance Trade Commissioner based out of the Embassy of Canada in Washington, D.C. I'm so happy to be back after a short hiatus, which had me traveling to a number of interesting conferences around the U.S., such as the Caribbean Renewable Energy Forum and the Bloomberg New Energy Forum. So really looking forward to getting back on course with these podcasts. If you've been listening to the podcast for a while or attending some of the climate finance webinars that I've hosted, then you would have heard me talk about the Development Finance Corporation, the U.S.'s development finance institution that came about in 2019. In those few short years, the DFC has made some impactful investments around the world and has committed its portfolio to some of the world's pressing issues, such as climate and gender. So I'm excited that I get to talk to Nadia Razi-Kowar, who is the Director for Business Development in the Office of Structured Finance and Insurance at DFC. In this role, Nadia focuses on an early deal origination and directly engages with project sponsors to determine their eligibility, terms, and structuring for DFC debt financing and political risk insurance. Nadia joined DFC's predecessor agency, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, or OPIC for short, in 2015 from the Department of Energy's Office of International Affairs, where she spent 3 years as a senior advisor in Latin America and the Caribbean. Nadia has also worked in the Environment Protection Agency's Office of the Chief Financial Officer and the Department of Justice's Law and Policy Office in Environment and Natural Resources Division. So clearly, Nadia knows what she's talking about when it comes to climate investment. Thank you, Nadia, for joining us today.
Thanks, Fahim. Nice to be here.
No, I'm really excited about this conversation because, as I mentioned today and then previously, you know, DFC along with FinDev Canada are relatively new institutions. And so a lot of the clients, the Canadian clients that I work with, are really curious to understand what DFC does. And I think there's a lot of opportunity with DFC when it comes to project finance. So I thought we could kind of kick off our conversation if you could just provide me a background or history of DFC and how it differs from your predecessor, OPIC.
Yes, happy to. So as you mentioned, there was legislation back in 2019 that actually turned the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, along with the USAID's Office of Development Credit Authority, into a new entity called the U.S. International Development Finance Corporation. And we officially opened our doors on January 2nd, 2020. For folks who are familiar with OPIC, you can think of DFC as building off of the original tools that OPIC had, which was medium and long-term debt financing, support for private equity funds, and political risk insurance. So in addition to those tools that we used to have, we have a few additional ones. Those are direct equity authority, as well as a technical assistance program, which is a 50-50 cost share grant program to help with pre-investment development or post-investment development. And in addition to those new tools, there's a number of other changes that DFC incorporated. Our investment cap doubled to $60 billion. We have a much broader presence abroad with business development folks that are in the sub-Saharan African continent, as well as in Asia. We have new offices, the chief development officer, the chief risk officer, the chief climate officer, and we have relaxed our U.S. nexus, which is probably good news for any Canadian developers out there interested in DFC support. When we were OPIC, we used to require at least 25% of the project equity coming from U.S. sponsors. That's been relaxed, and especially in the energy sector and in a few other priority sectors, that's actually not a requirement at all. So we do not actually need to see U.S. participation. It's always a great story, but not a requirement anymore. And one last thing to highlight about DFC is we have a mandate to have 60% of our overall portfolio to be focused in countries that are classified as low income or low middle income by the World Bank. So there's reinvigoration of our focus on the lowest income countries that need our support the most.
Great. Yeah. I think that emphasis on low income and low middle income is critically important. And $60 billion is a huge portfolio to manage. Just going back to the relaxing the Canadian nexus requirement, or sorry, the American nexus requirement, and no longer needing the 25% requirement, can you share with us what the priority sectors are for DFC, where there is no requirement at all for the U.S. nexus requirement, and what are the sectors, and in those sectors where there is a nexus requirement, how do you suggest Canadian companies work with American companies to attract DFC finance?
Sure. So if we're looking at projects involving the energy sector or hard infrastructure, we actually don't need a U.S. nexus. So we define the energy sector. We're looking at utility scale projects like wind and solar, hydro, geothermal, also looking at off-grid projects or distributed renewable energy projects also do not require a U.S. nexus. And then when we think broadly about hard infrastructure, that's when we're talking about toll roads and ports and water infrastructure and ICT technology and information technology infrastructure. So it's actually quite a lot, especially when we're talking about climate type projects where we don't need to see the U.S. nexus. Projects can also qualify if they're in a low income or low middle income country. Also, if they have a gender component that qualifies for our 2X program. So there's lots of ways to figure out how to work with us and a lot more flexibility. So I would focus on companies not worrying necessarily about whether or not they're qualifying, but instead coming to us with a project that looks bankable with a strong sponsor and let us work with them directly to figure out if they fit within our current parameters.
Okay, great. So on the subject of climate, I'm glad you mentioned that. Can you share DFC's commitment to climate investment? You had mentioned now there's a chief climate officer. So I just really want to hear about how that evolution has happened in DFC's commitment to climate investing.
Yes, absolutely. So Jake Levine is our chief climate officer, and he's really focusing on how we can expand our partnerships with certain companies and investors and stakeholders to be able to really tackle the climate crisis, you know, crowd in other capital and work with new partners and in new sectors where we haven't previously been active. Prior to this re-emphasis of climate, I think, at least from the energy perspective, our portfolio was very much focused on mitigation type projects, so solar, wind, electricity generation. And I think there's a much broader, we've opened the aperture much broader so that we can try to think about other climate friendly type investments, those that would address adaptation, vulnerable community, nature-based solutions. So there is a big drive internally to look for broader types of climate friendly investments. And we're building our pipeline as we speak. So again, for those listening, we're always willing to take a look at projects to give an assessment about whether there's something that we can support. And then in terms of just our own housekeeping, we have made a pledge for our own portfolio to reach net zero emissions in our portfolio by 2040. We are making sure with this net zero pledge that we're not just talking the talk, but they're walking the walk internally as well. So we have a technical assistance focus. We announced a commitment of at least $50 million over the next 4 years. This was announced last year. So 5 years total for feasibility studies and technical assistance to help identify, design, and implement new climate projects. Last year, we launched a call for distributed renewable energy applications. We got over 100 responses and requests for debt and equity, and we are working to advance a handful of those projects, hopefully to get those to commitment, because again, off-grid and distributed energy projects are a priority for us at the moment. And then, of course, we had a call for applications in our funds department for climate-focused funds. So you can see kind of across all of our new and you know, historic tools, we are really honing into where we can make an impact with climate.
Great. That's really helpful. And, you know, you had mentioned nature-based solutions and investing in adaptation. So can you talk to the patience of the capital that you deploy?
Yes. So we are a medium to long-term partner. So with, I mean, depends on the sector we're looking at and depends on the type of project, but we can offer pretty long tenors. So we're going to be with you in the long term. And then when it comes to, you know, supporting projects as they get up and running, we are a development bank. So we aren't necessarily in the business of walking through the full development process with a borrower. We want to see projects that are like ready for investment. But at the same time, especially with these critical sectors we've been talking about, I think we're happy to have early conversations and regular conversations to understand a project kind of in the earlier stages so that when it's ready for our support, when it's ready for our loan or political risk insurance, we've already become familiar with the project. And I guess I could say now that we have our new TA product, we're seeing more opportunities where the technical assistance can come in early to help with the development stage. And then that TA is tied to the idea that project could enter our pipeline for debt, political risk insurance, or equity down the line. So it's a great way for us to meet new clients, work with new clients early on, and hopefully get them through our full pipeline.
Okay. That's helpful. A couple of more questions just to follow up on that. With the technical assistance, or even let's say even political risk insurance, is that, you said it's a pipeline, but will you provide political risk insurance without investing into a project? Are those separated, or will you provide TA? And then if the project developer finds different funding, would they have to reimburse you for that TA?
Yes, great question. So for political risk insurance, we can actually, and have actually done both. We can provide standalone political risk insurance if that's what the project needs. Or there have been a handful of occasions in which we've provided both political risk insurance and debt to the same project. It just depends on the project and how we perceive the risks and, you know, if we can demonstrate that we're crowding in sufficient other capital. For the technical assistance question, yes, it is a 50-50 cost share grant program. The idea up front is that we hope that we could lend to the project down the line, but of course we can't always predict the future. So if the project is ultimately invested in by DFC or by another entity, DFI or commercial bank, then that grant becomes repayable to DFC. However, if the project ultimately take off, doesn't get financed, then the grant turns into a pure grant and we don't require it to be paid back.
Okay, good. I mean, that's definitely an effective TA facility where all the interests are met. I mean, it's great to see that DFC is taking risks using this TA facility. Can you also comment on the size of projects you're looking for?
Sure. If you go to our website, it says $1 million is the lowest amount that we could, you know, lend into a project. We don't technically have a lower bound necessarily, especially for some of these upcoming projects in the climate space. We do imagine that some of them might be a bit small, but something to keep in mind is that there are transaction costs to working with the DFI. You know, there's legal costs, there's often independent engineer costs or other consultants that we may have to hire, other external consultants. And so at some point, it doesn't make sense. It becomes too costly or not economic for a project to work with us because of those requirements. So for just as a baseline to give you, in our distributed renewable energy call for applications, we set the floor at $3 million. I would say, our typical small scale off-grid type project is probably around $5 million and higher. US dollars. And then of course, technically, we can actually go up to $1 billion with a B per project. And this is, you know, there are very few projects that would actually get that amount of capital. But, you know, it's relatively common to see us provide $150 million, $200 million, $250 million to a utility scale type project.
Okay. And where does DFC fit in the capital structure? Like, how much will they give to a project, mm-hmm. and, you know, will they take a first loss
Yes. So typically, as a lender, we are a senior lender. That's our traditional position. There are certain circumstances in which we might consider putting in a junior position. We've done that in a couple of the off-grid focused debt funds. And I think there is more of an appetite to take more and more risk these days. What it ultimately looks like is still sort of to be determined. But a first loss is not our traditional position. For the second part of your question, we can actually, by statute, provide up to 80% of the total project cost in a project. And then that remaining 20% or X percent, we would want to see in equity. Now, that's a typical gearing for a utility scale type project, 75-25, 80-20, when there's a power purchase agreement, you know, contracted offtake. In projects that are in the off-grid and distributed renewable energy sector, we typically see leverage closer to 50-50 or maybe 60-40 debt to equity. So it depends on the type of project and then, of course, the offtake arrangement.
Okay. This is really helpful just so we can get a sense of, or even me, get a sense of what companies can work with you and at what point in their maturity they can work with you. And it sounds like, you know, you want them, you're not looking at concepts or early stage, you want to see something developed and that's investable. And I suppose that's where you would come in.
That's right. I think we aren't the right lender for a pilot project. Typically, we don't take complete risk when it comes to technology risk. Like I think we are leaning in, especially in the climate sectors, but we usually like to see the technology being proposed for the project has been used at commercial scale elsewhere.
Okay. And could that commercial scale be demonstrated in a developed country?
Yes, it could be demonstrated in a developed country. Yes.
Yeah. All right. So that's really helpful. Can you share what you look for in a project developer? Like, what are the characteristics?
Yes. So speaking on the debt side, which is where I sit in the department, we are looking for developers, project sponsors who have a track record of developing the same type of project in either in the same market or in other markets. So we do look for a strong track record and a strong management team. In the case of a newer company, we want to see people who have demonstrated the ability to develop, raise financing for, you know, reach COD and potentially operate similar projects elsewhere. We also want to see companies that have a track record raising equity and that, or that have already raised equity or very close to reaching that stage in the project, because that gives us comfort that, you know, that there's the equity in place and that they're ready. We want to see the requisite studies undertaken, and depending on the sector, it'll differ, but we want to see those in place. And we do have a very robust environmental and social review. And so we will be asking for the environmental and social impact assessment or other environmental and social studies that have been undertaken for the project. And that's one of the first areas where we look to make sure there's no red flags on the ENS side.
Okay. Yeah. Then that all sort of comes into the due diligence and transaction costs you mentioned earlier, which, you know, when I was at IFC, we had estimated that to be, just for our listeners' information, upward of $150,000. I mean, obviously it depends on the transaction, the complexity, but I think that was the least amount that the due diligence would have cost. So just so people get a sense of why smaller projects don't necessarily get all of the funding is because there is a due diligence process that looks into these factors that you mentioned. Can you tell me, we talked about climate as a sector, what are other sectors that are of interest to DFC, and what are the geographies where you focus? So, you know, where do you like to see more projects?
Yes. So in addition to what we discussed in terms of climate and energy type projects, the other key sectors for us include financial inclusion, food security and agriculture, global health, infrastructure and technology, and water, sanitation, and hygiene. And then we have some cross-cutting themes, which touched upon a little bit, but gender being one of them, bolstering manufacturing and global supply chains is another example. And then in terms of geographies, we are open very broadly in most emerging markets. We actually, if people are interested, we have a link on our website that actually indicates which countries where we are specifically open. As I mentioned before, it includes most low and low middle income countries. There's a big focus on Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, the Middle East, Latin America and the Caribbean, the Indo-Pacific. And in particular, these days, given geopolitical circumstances, particularly Eastern Europe is a strong area of focus, particularly for the energy sector.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. In one question, going back to investment, when you're doing lending, is it in US dollars or is it in local currency?
Yes, very good question. So technically, DFC, when it was created, was given the statutory authority to lend in local currencies. But practically speaking, it has been challenging for us given the cost. So effectively right now, you can think of us as a US dollar lender. Hopefully in the future, you'll hear that that's different. And at this stage, we do offer a guarantee product that has helped us lend in countries where local currency has been needed by the project. And essentially what that means is that we would provide a guarantee to a local bank, and that local bank would then disperse the funds in local currency. So that's how we structure it at this stage.
Okay, that's really helpful to know. And finally, you know, looking at the Canadian companies, when they want to come and talk to you, how can they best prepare for a meeting with you about the renewable energy project or a project in one of the other sectors that you mentioned?
Yes. So I would encourage anybody interested to take a look at our website. We actually have a full list of all of the projects that we've supported that are in our portfolio, so you can get a sense of the types of projects. And that kind of helps just give some more color around what we've been able to finance. But the first thing that we would want to do is have a conversation and see the business plan. So we get so many requests that I personally do request to see materials about the project before I'm able to engage over the phone. But we would review the business plan and give feedback. And usually along with the business plan, it helps to have a financial model and any financials on the company, particularly if you're requesting a corporate loan. So we're looking for sponsors to be really clear about what the scope of the project is, what the use of proceeds would go to. We want to understand, as I mentioned before, the company's track record, their financial situation. We want to understand their company ownership and project ownership, because we do a KYC, Know Your Customer, assessment of major shareholders in the project. We want to understand the market and the market factors around the project. And we want to understand what makes your opportunity different, unique in the market, and what development goals does it strive to achieve? Because at the end of the day, while we are a development bank, we are a commercial lender. We don't provide concessional financing. We look at everything through the lens of development. So those are kind of the top line items that we would want to see. And then once we have a chance to take a look at the business proposal, the business plan, we would come back with a series of questions. There's always this sort of back and forth with questions, and also meet to have a phone conversation to get to know this prospective client better. And then, you know, if you do go through the process with us, you would start up front either with me or someone else working in business development, or even an investment officer directly. That we don't have business development just concentrate in one place in our agency. It's actually quite diffuse. So you would go back and forth. We would understand the project. If we think it looks good, we would screen it. And what that means is we would create a memo about the top line items of the project. And we would have an internal meeting with our vice president, with legal, with the policy folks, with the credit folks, and make sure there's no red flags. And if we get the green light upon having that screening meeting, then we would move forward and sign a retainer letter and get paid a retainer. And we would amass a group that would work on this of investment officers and a managing director. And we would start with due diligence. And depending on the size of the project, there are different approvals. Well, it would go to our credit committee if over $10 million, if over $20 million of debt. it would go to our investment committee. And if over $50 million, it would go to our board of directors. And every project goes through a congressional notification if it's over $10 million. And then after those approvals, it would get a commitment, and then we would do the documentation on the legal side and sign the loan agreement and then disperse. And it's so hard to tell you how long that process takes.
That was gonna be my next question. Yeah.
And the size, the complexity of the project, if there's any challenges in the country that might make the project make it harder for the project to advance quickly. But you know, it's so hard to say. 6, 9, 12 months are probably typical timelines for really large infrastructure projects. They can take years to get to financial close. It really, really is project specific, and that's something that we could talk to any individual developer about so that they have expectations for timing and our process.
What are typical red flags that you would see in a project that the project developer should avoid?
Yeah, good question. Well, I mentioned the environmental and social. Often those are our challenges for us that would raise red flags if we don't have, for instance, if we need an environmental and social impact assessment, we don't have one that's up to IFC standards, because those are the standards with which we require for ENS. Those can often challenge a project. Project sponsors that come to us that don't have a partner or equity or any entity in the transaction that has that track record we're looking for, that can thwart a project. If the project comes to us, you know, before they've raised any equity, you know, we would wait to start in earnest until that equity raise has been completed. Those are kind of the first that come to mind that have been challenging for projects. There's also the KYC, Know Your Customer, where those have created some challenges for us. So those are kind of the top line ones.
Do you look at who the equity investors are before you make a decision?
Yes. Yes. We want to know who they are, and you know, they're up to the beneficial owner. We look at the ownership broadly of the project up to the beneficial owner. And we also, one of the early questions that we ask is, what is the track record of the equity in the sector? You know, have they been investors in this type of sector? Because again, we want to see track record there as well.
Okay. Well, this is all really helpful, Nadia. And I encourage our listeners to reach out to me if you have any questions. And I'm happy to connect you with Nadia or her colleagues at DFC or in with our Canadian companies. Get in touch with your local trade commissioner, who then can connect you to me. So thank you, Nadia, for all of your insight and sharing the opportunities with DFC. I certainly learned a lot about DFC, despite, you know, having worked with you for a while. There were some really good insights here, which I think will provide some clarity to some of the companies that we're working with.
Great. I'm happy to have had the chance to speak with you, and I look forward to connecting with companies.
Wonderful. And thank you to our listeners for all your support. Please feel free to share this podcast with your colleagues, post it on social media, and also share your comments of this podcast on your favorite podcast platform. That way I can understand if the information that is being shared through this podcast is valuable and relevant. This podcast, the Understanding Climate Finance Podcast, is a production of the Embassy of Canada in Washington, D.C. So thank you, everyone, and I look forward to our next episode.